This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Vice President Biden warns Russia to reduce tensions in Ukraine, while President Obama tries to turn his focus to Asia with his trip there this week. Jeb Bush is sounding more like a potential presidential candidate. It's primary election season across the country ahead of the 2014 midterm elections, and pundits are already pondering the political aspects of Hillary Clinton becoming a grandmother. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us once again to analyze the world of U.S. politics. You can join the conversation. Our number is 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. You can also post on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Ken, thanks for being with us again this afternoon.
Thank you, Jay and Howard.
And as always, you'd like to start out with a trivia question, and you've already warned me in advance, but this is a fun one.
Okay.
Yes, and I think Howard would like it. And of course, I always know that no matter what the question is, Howard says, "Oh yeah, I know it." Okay. But the question is, who was the last vice president elected the same year an Ohio professional football, basketball, baseball, or hockey team won a championship?
Ooh.
The last vice president elected the same year an Ohio professional football, basketball, baseball, or hockey team won a championship.
And we're talking the actual
vice presidential candidate, right? That's correct. Okay. Who? What was the name of the vice president? Who was the vice president elected that year?
In the same year that a sports team essentially won a championship in Ohio.
Ohio statewide. You have other teams in Ohio.
Okay. And football, basketball, baseball, or hockey. Okay.
I think you might have stumped Howard. He looks a little perplexed.
Yeah, I'll think about that.
But in fairness, he has a notepad here, and he usually writes down the answer for me.
And what does the correct winner win?
A political junkie button that we now have
in stock here.
That's right. Yeah.
So if you think you know the answer to that question, 513-419-7100. Again, 513-419-7100. Well, we have lots to talk about. I have a handful of little headline things here printed out. But let's start with the president's trip to Asia. What do we make of that trip to Asia by our president?
Well, basically, what President Obama is trying to do is basically soothe U.S. allies in the Far East and in Asia over what's going on in the world. I mean, it's here at home, foreign policy is not what determines elections, but right now, foreign policy seems to be the headlines in every newspaper around the country, mostly about what to do with Ukraine. And so you have, you know, you have excursions with China. There's a report out this week that North Korea may be doing some more underground nuclear tests. So there's a lot of skittish U.S. allies in South Korea, in Malaysia, in Japan, in the Philippines that are just nervous. And, you know, American foreign policy leadership is probably being questioned more now than it's ever been before, more in doubt, more skittish allies. And so Obama has a lot to talk about.
And we should point out that this trip was originally planned for last fall in October, and I believe it was the same time as the federal government shutdown, so the president didn't feel like he could leave with those talks going on. So this is actually a make-good for a trip that was supposed to happen last fall.
Didn't that government shutdown seem like a million years ago? I mean, I mean, the Republican Party was shooting itself in the foot, and everybody was saying that this is a big, great year for the Democratic Party because the Republicans don't know what they're doing. And now who knows? But of course, we've also gone through a period where it didn't seem like the Democratic Party knew what it was doing, given the botched rollout of the Affordable Care Act. And we don't even know if the Affordable Care Act is affordable anymore. So there are so many questions going on.
How do you think the Chinese are looking at this trip as he tries to make friends with everybody else in Asia?
Well, they're looking at it, and you just wonder what the you know, once upon a time in 2008, and that was a million years ago as well, when George W. Bush's foreign policy was under such criticism and just, you know, such being disparaged around the world, and President Obama, the sense was the argument from the Obama camp was that this guy will give us a new sense of leadership around the world, and right now that's not the case.
What about the vice president's trip to the Ukraine? Same thing?
I think so. I mean, you know, basically, we're in big trouble if Joe Biden goes to Kiev and says, we're going to draw a red line from Moscow, and they can't go into Moldova or go into further incursions into eastern Ukraine. It's just, you know, all we seem to be able to do is right now is just put up warnings and perhaps suggest more and more sanctions. And while the Russian economy seems to be hurting from the sanctions, none of this seems to be dissuading Putin from doing what he wants to do, and that is take back, you know, the parts of the Soviet Union that just was lost to Moscow in the 1990s. So, you know, nothing seems to be dissuading Putin at all. He's going to do what he wants to do. And right now, you know, you could send Vice President Biden to Kiev. You could send him to anywhere you want. But right now, all it seems to be is just some kind of a face-saving thing, and nothing seems to be getting accomplished. I don't know what can be accomplished. Nobody, for example, you don't have John McCain or Lindsey Graham or senators right now saying, let's send troops to Ukraine, which they did during Syria, let's send more arms to fight Assad. Right now, nobody's talking about that kind of stuff, boots on the ground.
With, and for the record, Howard has written down an answer.
Yeah, I have.
I tell you what, we've got five folks lined up here to take a stab at this, so let's try Kim one more time before I take the first call here.
The last vice president elected the same year as a team from Ohio, professional football, basketball, baseball, or hockey team won a championship.
All right.
Same year. Who was the vice president elected that year?
All right, let's start with Matt in Westchester. What is your guess, Matt?
I'm going to say George H.W. Bush Sr.
George H.W. Bush Sr., Ken.
And what year was that?
What year? It was 1988-89.
And who was the team who won the championship in Ohio?
Who was the team?
Yeah, the team name.
I'm going to say maybe hockey. I don't know.
I think Ken's moving the goal line here.
Okay.
Well,
all right.
Well, no. Well, the problem is that he said George H.W. Bush in 1988, and of course, George H.W. Bush was elected president in 1988. I want to know who was the vice president elected the same year an Ohio team won the championship.
I thought vice president elected president. Okay.
All right, Matt, we appreciate your guess there. Let's try Jim in Green Township. Jim, go ahead.
It's Tim.
Oh, Tim, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm going to go 1976, Big Red Machine, Walter Mondale.
Walter Mondale, Ken.
That is the correct answer.
That's right, yeah.
And Howard did not get it right.
Yeah, I did not. Yeah,
1976, Jimmy Carter and Walter.
And what happened that year?
I think the Yankees had a lead until the game started.
Yeah.
And they got swept in four by the Reds.
Thank you very much.
1975-76 Reds team, an amazing team, and an amazing Jimmy Carter Walter Mondale team. I mean, one of the greatest duos. I mean, they were very successful until 4 years later when the Carter Mondale ticket captured six states in 1980, which is not so good for a sitting president. Anyway, 1976, right. Mondale and the Cincinnati Reds. Whenever I think of the Cincinnati Reds, I always think of Walter Mondale. I'll be honest with you.
Well, Jim, we appreciate your guests. Hold the line,
Tim,
and we'll get
Tim.
I'm sorry. Somebody typed Jim up here, and that's what I keep saying. So, Tim, thank you, and hold the line, and we'll get you your political junkie button. Howard, you should have known that.
I really should. Yeah, I mean, I'm not thinking straight today, Ken. I don't know what's the matter with me. I went all the way back to 1940, with Henry Wallace when the Reds beat the Tigers.
Well, actually, in 1964, didn't the Browns win the championship?
Yeah, right.
And you could have had Hubert Humphrey in 1964. Humphrey.
I thought about that, right. Too, yeah.
Well, we were talking about October being a long time ago, and October's when folks began signing up for the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, and that rollout did not go very well. And at the time, there were some folks calling for Kathleen Sebelius to step down as a Health and Human Services Secretary, and she did that.
That never happened.
And she did that recently. Why now?
Well, there's a lot of things that are different. First of all, one thing that would have mattered if she had resigned back then, as a lot of Republicans were pressing the White House to make happen, but had she resigned back then the Senate rules meant that whomever President Obama would nominate to succeed her needed 60 votes to beat back a filibuster. Now that's not the case anymore because Harry Reid and the Democrats changed the filibuster rules in the Senate. Now you just need a Senate bare majority. But back then you needed 60 votes, and there was no way that anybody Obama named would have gotten past 60 votes without a Republicans bringing back the Affordable Care Act debate in the Senate. So that was one reason why the president didn't want to get rid of Sebelius back then. Also, he didn't want to give in to the critics. Given the terrible things that were going on with the website, he didn't want to say, okay, you know, you're right, we screwed up, goodbye Kathleen Sebelius. One, Sebelius was a big Obama supporter in 2008. She backed him early when Hillary Clinton was running, and he didn't forget that. Plus, he just didn't want to give in to the critics and say, you know, I'm going to throw her overboard because you guys are right. But ultimately, there were things that she did well and things that she didn't do well. And I think they wanted to get that botched rollout past them before it was time for her to go. And they didn't want to do it any later in the calendar year because the last thing they want to do is debate Obamacare closer to the election.
Does Sebelius have any chance of or aspiration of running for president?
Oh, gee, I don't think so. I mean, once upon a time, the thought was, and she was very, very popular when the Republican Party was eating its own in Kansas. There was some talk about her running for the Senate. Now, as you well know, no Kansas Democrat has been elected to the Senate since 1932. And so that would have been a tough order for anybody, let alone Kathleen Sebelius. But my sense is that her political career is over, and that's it for her on a ballot.
We are talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin, and we're going to continue our conversation after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Our guest today is political junkie Ken Rudin. He joins us once a month to talk about U.S. politics. You're invited to join the conversation. Our number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100.
Ken, Howard, I just heard that fundraising pitch by Ken Rudin. I was so moved. I just loved it. I'm serious. I loved it. I was so touched.
We take all major credit cards.
It was a beautiful thing, yeah.
before the break, we were talking about Kathleen Sebelius stepping down as the Health and Human Services Secretary. Just right before she announced she was stepping down, the numbers came out on the actual enrollments, and the White House had projected 7 million folks would sign up. I think the number was actually closer to 8 million, and the demographics of the people who signed up were younger than what opponents had been predicting. Does that give the Democrats some breathing room now that maybe the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare won't be such the issue in this upcoming midterm election?
I don't think it gives them breathing room, but I think it gives them, it's encouraging, and I think it's good news. I mean, again, good news is always good to have. The fact is that 8 million, if not more than 8 million people have signed up for it. The fact that many young people, which is exactly what the program needs, many young people have signed up for it, and that's very, very encouraging. But again, as I said earlier in the show, is the Affordable Care Act affordable? Premiums are either already gone up or expected to go up. Now, they've been going up all along anyway, but there were so many promises and so many assumptions made about Obamacare when it first came into play that it was going to be the panacea that some thought that for so many things, and that may not be the case. So the fact is, as President Obama's numbers have not really recovered yet in national polling, the Affordable Care Act's numbers have not recovered yet either. There's still a plurality, if not a majority, of the American people who don't like it. But at the same time, and in all fairness, they don't want it repealed. And the Republican Party is campaigning on let's repeal it and just, you know, defund it and repeal it. And that's not what the American people want either. So you have a lot of Democratic senators, and the battle for the Senate will be furious this year. A lot of Democratic senators are very, very wary. They say, look, it's not working perfectly, but it's better than what the Republicans or the alternative, what the Republicans are suggesting. It is going to be still a key issue for November.
Well, in some of these Senate races that are in play, I mean, the Democrats could use that as a motivator for their base. I mean, you know, here's these big bad Republicans want to come in and take away Affordable Care Act and maybe use that as a motivator to get people to the polls.
Yeah, I thought of that too, and I still don't think I haven't been seeing that going on. What I do see Democrats doing is perhaps maybe trying to change the subject. They're saying not that the big bad Republicans are taking away the Affordable Care Act, but the big bad Republicans are refusing to allow the minimum wage to be increased, or they're refusing to allow unemployment insurance to be extended, or they're battling women on reproductive rights, or they're battling African Americans and minorities on voting ID laws. So I think what the Democrats are desperately trying to do, is to remind their base that they still stand for these things on pay equity and things like that, and maybe just move away from the Obamacare conversation totally.
Well, there are different issues that could work better in different places. I mean, in Ohio, they could, you know, they're really pushing Democratic voters, particularly African American voters, on this voting rights issue.
No, that's absolutely true. And I think both, you know, they're desperately trying to recreate the Democratic coalition of 2008 and 2012, which was getting young people, women, African-Americans, Latinos, other minorities out. And it's tougher, you know, it's obviously tougher for the party in the White House to reproduce the kind of coalition you got in a presidential year in a midterm election. Just think of 2004 when the Republicans were in power. They got a majority of the vote in the presidential race, but they couldn't get their voters excited in the 2006 midterms, given the unpopularity of the war in Iraq, the response to Katrina, the failing economy, and the Democrats benefited. So it's, you know, it's one thing to have a great coalition during a presidential election with President Obama on the ballot. It's going to be tough to reproduce that in 2014, and the Democrats know that.
Back to the Health and Human Services Secretary, what do we know about, what can you tell us about the person who has been selected by the president to replace Kathleen Sebelius?
Well, I was afraid of that question because the name just slipped my mind as I was talking about her before, but she is somebody who's widely respected in Congress. The Republicans and the Senate voted for her. She is the budget director. Somehow the name is failing me. But at the same time, you just know that any kind of confirmation hearings, and of course, with the changing of the rules, it's the likelihood of her being confirmed is almost not in question. But it will give the Republicans once again to debate Obamacare. And I guess, as you suggested, perhaps with the new enrollment numbers, it gives the Democrats more ammunition to make their case. But at the same time, Republicans would welcome that fight.
We were talking about Kathleen Sebelius' future plans. You'd mentioned, maybe running for Senate in Kansas. There was a story this morning on Morning Edition about Bob Dole touring Kansas, and I believe it said that he is 90. So why is 90-year-old Bob Dole touring Kansas?
Well, you know, there's a new appreciation. I mean, everybody always loved the witty, sarcastic, fun Bob Dole. He didn't have the greatest 1996 campaign for president. It was just probably doomed from the start. The Gingrich-Dole contract with America Republican Congress may have gone so far that it just enabled Bill Clinton to win a second term. But there is a, you know, Bob Dole is old. He's in failing health, and he is a very proud man, and he's a veteran, true and true. There was a Washington Post story the other day that just talked about how whenever he talks about people, he always wants to know if there are veterans in the audience. He gave so much of his personal life, of course, the loss of an arm, the use of his arm, but he gave his whole life. He was elected to Congress, I think, in 1960. So we're talking about a long time there, spending on behalf of the country. And so he comes back to Kansas every now and then. Of course, he was, you know, served as a Kansas senator and congressman for so long. He lives, of course, in the Watergate office building, apartment building in Washington for so many years. But his roots and his heart is still Kansas. And when he goes home, I think the people back home, you know, just appreciate him even more. He's a remarkable human being, and I used to know him pretty well back in the day, and I haven't talked to him in many, many years. You could see he's in failing health. Whenever I hear an interview with him, he sounds old. I mean, he sounds 90, and we forget that somebody who had such energy, they do get old, but we still cherish them the same.
And
sort of like Howard Wilkinson.
Yeah, that's right. No, you know, I mean, I covered him quite a bit in '96 and traveled with him, and I mean, he was delightful to be around. You know, I mean, he was great. He'd come up and, you know, to the front of the plane, he'd talk all day long, and, you know, and he was funny and witty, and he was just
but
fun to cover.
But every now and then you see old resentments coming up. Of course, when he ran against in 1988, when he ran against George H.W. Bush,
right.
You know, the famous quote on NBC, tell him to stop lying about my record. But
right.
He always resented the privileged. And they, I guess he always felt that George Bush Sr. was privileged, and he wasn't such a sense. It was in a sense, but that Bob Dole was scrappy. He had to do everything on his own. He had to make the money on his own. And he was just a regular guy.
Yeah.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin. If you have a question, 513-419-7100. Again, 513-419-7100. And we have checked Sylvia Matthews-Burwell is the nominee
That's
to
right.
replace Kathleen Sebelius as Health and Human Services Director, and she is currently the OMB Director in the White House. Since I'm the baby in this conversation, when you and Howard are officially old, I will say nice things about you, too.
Jay, I forgot. What are we talking about? Sorry, I can't remember.
Well, we have gone just about halfway through this program, and it's probably long enough that we now know that Hillary Clinton is going to be a grandmother, and there has been some talk about how that will play into her decision, or will it be used as an issue should she decide to seek the presidency in 2016.
I think you're missing the real question. The real question is, how does the baby affect what's going on in Ukraine? Because ultimately, look, it's amazing what I've been reading. I mean, it's just, I mean, look, John Stewart pointed this out the other day, and I thought it was just masterful. He said, look, Mitt Romney has 73 grandchildren. Nobody, or something, whatever the number was, nobody asked Mitt Romney, can you run for president with all these grandchildren? But it's the kind of question you ask of a woman. And I thought he put it really well. But it's just so funny that, you know, everybody's talking about what this means about whether she's running for president and how does it affect her decision? Well, I mean, first of all, there's no doubt in my mind that Hillary Clinton is running. Two, the thought that Chelsea designed it, this is what I read in some blogs, that Chelsea and her mom designed the pregnancy now so it coincides with the release of Hillary's new book and the presidential race and how that comes into play. I think they're missing the real point. The real point is that we need a Clinton and Bush legacy to go on forever. So I figure if Hillary Clinton runs against Jeb Bush in 2016 and blah, 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 then in 2020, Chelsea Clinton runs for president against George P. Bush, who's running for agriculture commissioner in Texas. And then the baby, male or female, He or she will be 35 years old in the year 2049. So in the next presidential race after that, this baby runs for president against George P. Bush's child. But here's the thing though, nobody's mentioned either. When this baby is born in this fall, what did he or she know about Benghazi? These questions need to be asked, and that's why I'm serious. That's why I love WVXU, because it gives me the platform to ask the kind of questions that America needs to hear. Is this on?
There was also a piece on Morning Edition, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, that your friend Mara Liasson did, about how everything in the Democratic Party seems to be aligning for Hillary to be the candidate, setting up the machinery for that to happen. Do you sense that?
I do, and then it's pretty remarkable because, you know, I mean, when you think of an open presidency, the last time there was an open presidency was 2008 when George W. Bush couldn't run again, and you had eight candidates. You had Hillary Clinton, who was clearly the front runner then, but you had Barack Obama and Bill Richardson and Chris Dodd and Joe Biden. I don't know whatever happened to Joe Biden, but I think he went on to some other job. But you had all these people, Dennis Kucinich, running for president. Now, with another open presidency, the feeling is that the nomination cannot be taken away from Hillary Clinton. She's earned it. The women feel that this is their time. And this is kind of remarkable to say that, given the fact that women are the majority of this country. But they said, OK, this is, you know, we're not going to be deterred. This is Hillary Clinton's time. And I think that's the case. You may see some kind of Democrats around the country thinking about it. Martin O'Malley, the outgoing governor of Maryland, is saying, well, maybe, Hillary won't dissuade me. By the way, I call her Hillary because there were two Clintons, and I think that calling her Clinton just seems weird. But I don't mean to be so familiar with her that I call her by her first name. But anyway, so I think I just can't imagine anybody taking the nomination away from her. And the question is, is there such a thing as Clinton fatigue? You know, right now her numbers are good, but there'll be more and more questions about what she did as Secretary of State. And we learned, as we learned from John Kerry, once upon a time, John Kerry was an amazingly successful Secretary of State until he no longer became a successful Secretary of State. Witness Israel versus the Palestinians. So you just wonder how many questions regarding Obama foreign policy will rub off on Hillary Clinton. And at the same time, you know that the Republicans are so well qualified to eat their own in the primary process that it's something for both parties to pay attention to.
Where does all this leave Joe Biden? Is he just out in the cold?
I think so, and I think he knows that, and I think it's pretty remarkable. I mean, he made two abortive bids for the presidency, of course, in 1987, which didn't go anywhere, and he was the guy who led the Senate battle against Robert Bork, and of course, his campaign kind of fell apart when he was accused of plagiarism. That's the famous quote that the Dukakis people uncovered. And then, of course, he ran for president in 2007, 2008, and that also went nowhere. And he was out of the race the night of the Iowa caucuses. And, of course, he was running against superstars like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But it's remarkable when you think of a vice president, if a vice president, wants the presidency in a year when the presidency is open, he gets it. Richard Nixon in 1960, Al Gore in 2000, George H.W. Bush. He had a fight with Bob Dole, but it was his in 1988. Walter Mondale, you remember that guy from the Cincinnati Reds? Walter Mondale was somebody who was a former vice president, but the nomination was his when he ran in 1984. The thought of Joe Biden, being an afterthought, given the fact that he's a two-term and quite successful vice president, is pretty remarkable. You have to go back to 1952 and Alvin Barkley, the last time a sitting vice president wanted the presidency, and the party said, uh-uh.
Yeah, and and for Joe Biden, you believe that he's come to that realization then?
I think he does. You know, he's made the obligatory trips to Iowa and to New Hampshire, and there are a lot of people who love him. And let's face it, we wouldn't, not that we wouldn't be having this conversation about same-sex marriage if it weren't for Joe Biden, but it was Joe Biden who said, hey, this is nonsense, this is insane, this should be a policy, this should not be, this should be no question. And then it took, then President Obama said, uh-oh, he jumped the gun,
right.
I guess, you know, I'll come forward. So, I mean, you could always talk about Joe Biden's gaffes and his, you know, his the mistakes he does and the wacky things he says, and he does say wacky things, but
he's had a real impact on policy, too, sure.
He has, absolutely, and, you know, he may be a little more dovish than some of the conservatives in the Democratic Party would like, and perhaps even more dovish than Hillary Clinton would like, but the fact is he's going to be 73 years old in 2016, which is, you know, not, I mean, he would be the oldest person ever elected president for the first time, but there's no sign that that age is an issue with Joe Biden. It's just kind of sad that his timing worked out to the way that he's up against a powerhouse and a juggernaut like Hillary Clinton.
And before we go to break here, I did want to read Carol from Fort Thomas called to tell us how delighted she is that we are having Ken Rudin on the show on a regular basis. So thank you, Carol, for that comment. And Ken, there's a fan.
Carol, send me your phone number and maybe we can talk later. Just so lonely.
Today is our regular monthly chat with political junkie Ken Rudin, and we'll continue that conversation after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Political junkie Ken Rudin joining us today, as he does once a month, to talk politics. And you can join our conversation, 513-419-7100, or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, 513-419-7100. Ken, before we move on from talking about Hillary Clinton, at this point, is there anyone that she should worry could be the Barack Obama of 2016 that as to what happened to her in 2008?
Well, of course, I mean, we always talk about Jimmy Who in 1976. Nobody saw Jimmy Carter coming out of nowhere, but it's hard to imagine anybody coming out of the woodwork now and challenging her, or anybody coming out of the woodwork, period, because with the 24/7 news cycle, everybody is watching everybody. You know, you see names like Andrew Cuomo, you see names like Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, Elizabeth Warren. There are a lot of progressive Democrats who say Elizabeth Warren would be the dream candidate, and in fact would be preferable to Hillary Clinton, who is still kind of cautious, somewhat conservative on foreign policy. But look, you know, I love being surprised, and politics is all about surprises. And, you know, we have still 2 years to go before the Democratic nomination will be settled. But right now, it's hard to imagine anybody coming out. Whereas on the Republican side, I mean, it's like, who knows what's going to happen? There's no front runner. There's no nothing seems to make sense. You talk about Jeb Bush. You talk about Chris Christie. You talk about Rand Paul. You talk about Ted Cruz. You even talk about Rob Portman. It's wide, wide open. And you know, if I were Hillary Clinton, I would probably be as less visible as possible and just sit back and watch the Republicans do their thing as they usually do.
You, when we talked the last time, was April the 3rd, and you were doing a bracket challenge of the GOP contenders. And at that point, you were down to the final four, and you're now down to, I don't know if you'd call him your champion, but your winning bracket, the winner in your bracket contest of the GOP contenders.
Right. And the final two were Rand Paul and Paul Ryan. Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, and the Tea Party senator from Kentucky, and Paul Ryan, the 2012 running mate to Mitt Romney. And Rand Paul beat Paul Ryan. And I guess it opens up to the, you know, the question that a lot of people were asking, if Paul Ryan married Rand Paul, what would his name be? I mean, would it be Paul?
Well,
look, you know, there's a lot of things we have to consider. It's like when I was at NPR, there was a newscaster named Nora Rahm. And so I always wondered, if Nora Rahm married Rahm Emanuel, then her name would be Nora Emanuel. See, that was easy. But okay, how about this? How about this? While this medication I'm taking still hasn't worn off yet. What about if Rosemary DeCamp married William Kunstler, she would be Rosemary DeCamp Kunstler. And so these are the thoughts I have during Cincinnati Edition. That's why That's why people need to give money to the WBXU, because of insight. Like
this. Of course. Where else would you get this?
This drug you're on, is it legal?
No, but actually, Carol has already called me and said, "What are you doing, Ken? What are you doing?"
Well, as you had your bracket there, as we look right now, I guess we're what, 2.5 years away from the general election in 2016. As it stands right now, whose stock is rising in the GOP, and whose stock is maybe going down in the GOP contest?
Well, there were two candidates. There are two would-be candidates I want to talk about. One is Jeb Bush, and one is Rand Paul. And of course, if Jeb Bush married, no, forget about that. But the Jeb Bush thing is fascinating to me, because I don't think he really knows what he's going to do. There are a lot of Republicans who say that he's the only guy who could beat Hillary Clinton. He's somebody who could attract Latinos. He's somebody who could attract moderates and centrists. But there are a lot of Republicans who say, wait a second, we have Bush fatigue. We went through 8 years of George W. Bush, and the Bush name is still a four-letter word. We don't want to deal with this. And he's too moderate. He's still squishy. You know, he talks about illegally, people who come here illegally, it's part of an act of love. Now, Jeb Bush will say to you, he said, look, you have to have some kind of humanitarian reaction to the illegal immigrant situation. Yes, there are laws, but we have to understand why people are coming here. But for many conservative groups, they said, no, this is amnesty. A law is a law is a law. And Jeb Bush represents the wrong part, the non-conservative philosophy about this. So you have the Jeb Bush problem. Then you also have Rand Paul, who's an interesting guy. He's not that he's just conservative, but he's also, you know, we always talk about the Republican Party being a very militant on foreign policy. Rand Paul, like his father Ron Paul, are clearly not in you could almost say they're isolationists in the fact that, you know, foreign incursions, it just makes no sense. We have things at home that need to be taken care of first. And so you have an isolationist foreign policy in Rand Paul and an amnesty Republican in Jeb Bush. And these are two different kind of Republicans than we saw from John McCain or Mitt Romney.
And that's the kind of battle we're going to have in this primary, you know, or the primary season for 2016, that split in the Republican Party. But if they're looking at winning a general election, don't they have to look more towards the Jeb Bush types?
Well, it depends what your definition of what they want in 2016. Jeb Bush said, I'd rather win the election than win an argument, which is, you know, putting ideology mm-hmm. aside and trying to win. But there are a lot of people like Ted Cruz and others like Jim DeMint, the former senator from South Carolina, who's now the head of the Heritage Foundation. He says, I'd rather have 30 Ted Cruz's in the U.S. Senate than, you know, 60 Mitch McConnell's, for example. I mean, in other words, I don't need to have a majority if these guys are not really representing conservative principles. So there is that battle, whether you want to win or you want to be right. And, you know, as Barry Goldwater said in 64, you know, in your heart, you know, he's right. He wants to be right, but he won six states. And that's not the way the Republican Party, at least the so-called establishment Republican Party, wants to go if they're going to ever win the White House again. And remember, demographics are rapidly changing in this country.
Yeah, I mean, they're changing so quickly, and it's going to get even worse. I mean, even beyond 2016, is this Republican Party not going to have to change some of its basic philosophy?
Well, that's the question, and we're going to see voters, you know, in the caucuses and the primaries, and it's not even 2 years from now. It'll be probably decided by February of 2016, so we're talking about 21 months from now, and the battle is already underway. It's going to be fascinating to see if Jeb Bush wants to put himself and his family through it, because you know he's going to get a hard time. Even Donald Trump, and I can't believe I'm mentioning Donald Trump's name, but even Donald Trump mentioned Jeb Bush's name about the act of love, and Donald Trump got cheers and Jeb Bush got boos when you know that comment was made. So anytime Donald Trump gets cheers, you know something is very strange in this country. Although I've always thought that Donald Trump was the heir apparent for president.
You tried that joke the last time and it didn't work then.
I try it every time, every day I can. Day's ending in a Y. I use that joke.
You might want to retire that one.
I think I will.
Rand Paul was in Chicago, I believe it was earlier this week, about a more inclusive Republican Party, and he calling for widening the party's appeal to include more racial and ethnic minorities and younger voters, a clear majority of which President Obama won in 2008 and 2012. Your thoughts on that?
Yes, he is saying those things, and these are the right things to say. I mean, he is, as his father did. His father didn't get many votes. I mean, he didn't win any caucuses. Well, he didn't win any primaries. But he did read, there were a lot of young people who liked the message that the polls were talking about. You know, he's talking about reaching out. He spoke at, I think, Howard University. Rand Paul did. Howard University, the historically black college in Washington, D.C. He's talking about reaching out to Latinos. But at the same time, you know, he said some interesting things about the viability of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So there's one thing to have great rhetoric, and Rand Paul seems to understand what the Republican Party is lacking, but not everything that Rand Paul is saying with his record, it just jives up with what he said in the past. So it'll be very interesting to see where he decides to go. But right now, every time I hear Rand Paul, he says the Republican Party cannot win with its just, you know, with the groups it is appealing to right now. It needs to extend its reach, and we'll see if that approach works.
Sure, I took off the AP wire right before I walked in here to do the show. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and 21 other Republican senators are accusing President Obama of disregarding the rule of law and the Constitution by considering administrative changes to the nation's deportation policy. In a letter Thursday, the senators say changes under consideration would amount to, quote, near complete abandonment of basic immigration enforcement, end quote.
Well, you know, something I think President Obama is very aware of the two sides of the immigration law as he is pursuing this policy, because for all the talk about how Latinos have given up on the Republican Party and all that stuff, the Obama administration has deported more people here illegally than every other president combined. And there are a lot of pro-immigrant groups and saying, wait a second, we support you, but you know, what's going on here? At the same time, Obama realizes that if he's going to have any deal with the Republican Party, Boehner said just the other day, Speaker John Boehner said the other day that he's, you know, hell-bent on getting an immigration law passed through this Congress. But so if he's going to get any kind of agreement with the Republicans, he's going to obviously have to stick with what's going on right now. But I think Obama realizes that this is just untenable, and maybe the number of the deportations have gotten out of control. But if he changes that law, as Mitch McConnell says, if he changes that, well, see, here's it. Let me stop in mid-thought. By changing the law, he risks not being able to work out a deal with the Republicans. But where has the Republicans been all this time when Obama was staying with the law and reaching out to the Republicans to get an immigration deal? So, you know, I know McConnell's doing what he's doing, but I wonder if it's giving the Republican Party cover for a party that just seems unable, not unwilling, but unable to put its divisions on immigration policy behind them.
Speaker Boehner is actually in Southwest Ohio today for a speaking event, and there was a tweet from a local reporter that and it said Boehner would like to see immigration reform, but the appetite is, quote, not really good among his colleagues. And is that those rather conservative members of his caucus are what's tying his hands?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, in his heart of hearts, I really believe that Boehner would love to have a deal. And not only because it's good, it might be good for the Republican Party, it's just the right thing to do for the country. But there are a lot of members of the Republican caucus in the House that one, don't have any kind of minority populations in the district, and two, say that we were elected to enforce the law, and if people here are illegally, that's breaking the law, and they shouldn't be rewarded for that. So there is great divisions in the Republican Party. And, you know, Boehner, I mean, we were talking about, you know, upcoming primary May 6th in Ohio. There's no, I mean, look, John Kasich and Ed Fitzgerald will be the gubernatorial nominees, and there's no Senate race. People should take a look at the vote against John Boehner in that Republican primary. Yes. There was a Tea Party back candidate, somebody I never heard of, J.D. Winteregg.
He's
32 years old. But I mean, the Tea Party is putting in $300,000, $350,000 in his campaign saying Boehner must be stopped. Now, Boehner does very well at home. He got 85% of the vote the last two times out. But there is national Tea Party dissatisfaction with Boehner, and we'll just see if that translates into a vote against him on May 6th. I don't think it does, but it'll be fun. It'll be interesting to watch.
It does explain why John Boehner over the last week has been making one stop at one factory after another in his district. I mean, he's been out campaigning.
Well, you have to be. I mean, look, the fact is he always wins handily, but at the same time, with a primary coming up, and given the fact that Tea Party is putting in this money, it would be crazy for Boehner to not remember who are the people who send him to Washington every year, you know, every time since 1991. So he's doing the right thing by campaigning. And he also has $5.5 million in the bank, which is far more than the Tea Party is raising for the opposition.
Also, I wanted to let you know that Gail emailed to second Carol from Fort Thomas that she is glad that she can hear you again. And so now you probably can start a fan club.
In a phone booth, right, exactly. Gail, Carol, and Ken. Sounds like a law firm. I'm with Gail, Carol, and Ken.
We've got just about a minute left. This is going to be the last time we talk to you before the Kentucky primary. Do you expect any surprises in the Kentucky primary, especially in the Senate race with Matt Bevin and Minority Leader McConnell?
I don't. I mean, Bevin was the preferred candidate for the Tea Party for a long time, and his numbers don't seem to be increasing. I mean, we could be surprised. But again, and we pointed this out on your show before, as unpopular as President Obama is in Kentucky, so is Mitch McConnell, and not because of ideological reasons, but he's been around a long time. He's not, shall we say, a fresh face. And so I don't see a surprise, but you know it's going to be where the Republicans keep talking about they need six seats to win in November to win a majority of the Senate. But of course, they have to pay attention to states like Georgia, which also has a primary on May 20th. And the five Republicans in that race are outright winging each other. And for all we know, Sam Nunn's daughter could win in Georgia. So the Democratic nominee. So these are primaries in Kentucky and Georgia. The Republicans should be very, very concerned about, not that McConnell will lose, but the fact is you don't want to push the Republicans so far to the right, as the Republicans have done for president in the past, that it makes it difficult to recapture the center in November.
We've been talking with political junkie Ken Rudin. He joins us once a month to discuss politics, and you'll find links to his podcast and website at WVXU.org. Ken, it's been fun. Thanks for joining us.
It's been great joining you, Gail and Carol.
Thanks for
Thanks for
listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our technical director was Bruce Ellis. With Howard Wilkinson, I'm Jay Hanselman.